coordinate a series of lectures, mostly two a day for the next 2 weeks, on an interdisciplinary set of related subjects that are inspired by algorithms and algebra and geometry. We're going to have some guest lecturers. Some of the mathematicians we most admire happen to be in the area. We're going to cajole any of them to give talks, and some of them have already agreed to give talks next week or at the end of this week. And part of what our lectures will do is to try to give you a common language for their talks. Many of you are coming from many different levels and from many different backgrounds. I mean, basically, it's so beautiful here that if you were in functional analysis, you would say, yeah, I do algebra, if it would, you know, get you a plane ticket here, right? We need you to hammer us with questions outside and inside this room so we can sync up well with what's going on with you. And my introductory lecture, hopefully many of the objects I mention are going to be familiar to many of you, but not all of the objects will be familiar to all of you. And what I'm going to try to do is, through a few simple examples, looked at from a number of points of view, try to at least introduce the main characters in Soren and my series of lectures. And then Soren will give the first technical lecture, actually carefully working through from the beginning of the material. You, meanwhile, want to be thinking about what you'd really like to hear now that you're here. You know, start a functional analysis seminar, you know, whatever. We got started as graduate students in this stuff. We made some important friendships, like I met Mike Stillman, and I wrote the computer program Macaulay with Mike Stillman while I was still a graduate student. And there's a good chance, depending on how active you are here, that you will make some friendships that will lead to, you know, work you really like in the upcoming years. And that will happen if you as actively as possible get involved in seminars. So think what you'd like to see happening here in the afternoons. And we're going to have an organizational meeting after Soren's talk this afternoon, and we'll figure out more specifically what that's about. But let me start. So algorithms in algebra and geometry. So what is this about? Well, I mean, by analogy, if you look at linear algebra and Gaussian elimination, it's completely ubiquitous. It's an essential language and method in all of math, whether it's applied math, pure math, whatever subject you're interested in. And really, where Soren and I both started is, if you take algebraic geometry, then there's an AND now that goes with algebraic geometry that corresponds to Gaussian elimination, which is Grobner bases. By the way, there's a large number of copies of the book Cox, Little, and O'Shea that the MSRI has bought from people who didn't bring their copy. So you might want to rush to the office afterwards or pretend you need to get a drink during the talk or something like that, you know, and go out there and get some of those books. And actually, you can ask questions now. We've got plenty of time. There's always tomorrow. Try to get yourself into the mindset that six of you just walked into our offices and we're just sort of talking at a blackboard. And slow me down when I get a little wound up, okay? So at any rate, you can think of this as being the higher degree analog. But on the other hand, while Gaussian elimination is classical, the algorithms are relatively new. Stemming from the 70s onward. But one reason that we feel this material is essential or important for anybody in any related field is that what's happening is the influence of algebraic geometry through these computational methods is affecting a lot of neighboring fields. So it's becoming essential in other subjects. You know, in fact, that was, in particular, Mike Stillman and my surprise when we wrote a computer program to help compute examples inside algebraic geometry, is, you know, people inside algebraic geometry, I mean, it was helpful in some ways, but what happened more often was people outside of algebraic geometry would have a question. They wanted an algebraic geometer to give them an answer instead of rambling about schemes and sheaves and stuff like that. So, okay, I'll ask someone else, you know. And, you know, you put it on a computer, the computer comes out with numbers. It comes out with an answer. And that's often what people want, and that encouraged people to then explore and more carefully, well, you know, there must be a relationship or they wouldn't be coming up with this answer. What's the relationship? Okay. So basically, I want to tell you what the basic setup is. It sort of runs throughout this, is K is going to be a field. You know, for some interpretations, we want it algebraically closed, but we don't really care most of the time. S is going to be a polynomial ring in n variables over the field. And I, sitting inside S, is going to be, you know, some ideal. And basically, what the idea of Grobner bases are is, given I, Grobner bases give deformations from the ideal I, or the zero set defined by I, to what's called an initial ideal. That is generated by monomials. And what's helpful for computations is it's very much like I. In other words, I might not be a monomial ideal, but in as far as a monomial ideal can have similar properties to I, such Grobner bases can give us monomials ideals. So if we use the notation that I'm going to use a vector notation for monomials, so x to the a is x to the a1 product times xn to the an is a monomial sitting inside S, then by the same token, we can think of a1 through an as a non-negative integer vector, so it sits in the n-dimensional natural numbers. Then we get an interplay between, which we didn't have before, which is we can think of n of I as an ideal sitting inside S, or as the subset J, which is take all vectors B sitting inside the natural numbers such that B is greater than coordinate by coordinate A for some generator x to the a belonging to our initial ideal. I'm going to do an example shortly. Okay, and J is a union of translates of n to the n. So a combinatorist is happy when they see a situation like this because there are things you can count there when you have a union of translates like that. So the basic property of Grobner bases that allows it to both perform computations within algebraic geometry, but also to enable connections with other fields, is that it reduces geometric and algebraic questions to combinatorial questions. So there's an example that I want to use throughout this talk in a number of different guises, which will appear several times in Soren's talk also, which is the twisted qubit. Okay, so if you take two-dimensional space and think of it over the field K instead of the real numbers, and then map it to four-dimensional space by the following rule: if S and T are your coordinates for two-dimensional space, and let's say A, B, C, D are our coordinates for four-dimensional space, then we have a mapping which sends S, comma T to the four vector S squared, S cubed, S squared T, S T squared, T cubed. Since this map induces a map on the sets of lines through the origin in each of these spaces, and projective line, the projective one space is just the set of lines through the origin in two space, and projective three space is just a set of lines through the origin in ordinary four space. And so you get a curve, X, let's call it C, you get a curve sitting inside P3, and that's the twisted qubit. So the way in which one does algebra on this curve is you associate the polynomial ring A, B, C, D with P3 or A4, however you want to think about it, and you associate the polynomial ring S comma T with P1, and then for any particular, the function, A induces a function on this space, and this curve feels that function by this embedding, and it pulls back that function to a value here, and similarly B induces a function on this space, which when you restrict it to the curve, pulls back to a different value here. And so you get the map A goes to S cubed, B goes to S squared T, C goes to ST squared, and D goes to T cubed. And the kernel, this gives a ring homomorphism, and the kernel of this ring homomorphism is the ideal I, B squared minus AC, BC minus AD, C squared minus BD. So what one would study on the computer in place of the geometric object, the curve C sitting inside P3, one would study the algebraic object, this ideal, given explicitly by these generators. And you can think of this as the set of polynomials that vanish on C. Okay, so now, where did Grubner Bases get in the act? We choose some way to order monomials. If you want more basics on Grubner Bases, we're going to have working seminars in the afternoon to go through them carefully. What's one thing Cox, Little, and Moshe is really good for? But I want to consider here the reverse Lex term ordering. And intuitively, you can just say that when you're picking your favorite term, avoid the last variable D if at all possible. And if that doesn't seem to matter, then avoid C if at all possible. And that defines an ordering. Here, if we're avoiding C, we choose this lead term. If we're avoiding D, we choose this lead term. If we're avoiding D, we choose this lead term. And what happens is our generators for I form a Grubner basis. We're lucky. What makes this hard to do on the computer is that in general, you can have much larger sets, which are Grubner bases, than minimal generating sets. But this is a very special situation, and which we'll see in many ways, and we're very lucky here. And so we get a deformation, I, which goes to n of I, which is simply the monomial ideal whose generators are B squared, BC, and C squared sitting inside S. Okay? And as I said, there's combinatorics here, and the true picture for the set J, which I defined on the first board, on the board over to the right, would take place in four dimensions. But you get the essence of it in two dimensions. So if we do a 2D picture of J, I'm just going to plot, I'm going to make the following correspondence, that B squared I'm going to write down as just 2, 0. BC I'm going to write down as 1, 1. C squared I'm going to write down as 2, 0. So I'm just taking the middle two exponents. So I'm going to plot the exponents of B and C. Then what happens is you can think of all the monomials that live in this monomial ideal as simply, if you take all the lattice points in this picture, and then you draw one of the generators. Here's the generator B squared, and look at the translated orthon you get. Here's the generator for BC, look at the translated orthon you get. Look at the generator for C squared, here's the translated orthon you get. There's a picture like this in four dimensions. We're drawing it in two dimensions. And somehow, how these different orthons meet each other carries combinatorics, which tells us a lot about the original curve, the twisted cubic. Okay. So, if I'd been giving this talk, say, a dozen years ago, and I gave such talks a dozen years ago, I would have gone on in a very different direction. There are aspects of the combinatorics of monomial ideals which kinds of monomial ideals do you get when you apply general change of coordinates to your ring first? So they have special properties. There are a lot of aspects of monomial ideals which are crucial if you're writing the computer program to do this stuff. But those are different aspects than the ones that have been uncovered by the applications. So what's happened in the last dozen years is that there have been a lot of applications of these methods to a variety of different fields. And I want to draw a very crude Venn diagram for you. This is, I mean, interdisciplinary stuff is by its nature a changing border. So you don't take this Venn diagram too seriously. But, you know, we started in algebra. If I were to give a book which you could look at for beginner, for starting out, to see what kind of algebra enters into this Venn diagram. There's also the subject of convex polytopes, or you know, you can think of this as linear programming, or you could think of this as integer programming. And you know, some, you can consider that as part of combinatorics or part of many things, but it's a very big subject on its own. It's incredibly important in many applications. Linear programming has more people involved in it than mathematics does, perhaps. It's used to make things work efficiently in the world. Then we also have combinatorics, and we also have topology. And what I want to study are objects that sort of vaguely lie in the interplay between all these subjects. And I want to begin to sketch some of the interactions between these subjects. If I were suggesting first books to look at for each of these, the book that I recommend here would be a book by Sturmfeld, Grobner Bases and Convex Polytopes. You should be able to read that comfortably at the end of these talks. If you can already read it, let us know. We'll think of some seminars for you. And the first thing I would look at for the combinatorics in this sense is a book by Richard Stanley, Combinatorics and Commutative Algebra, second edition. And the place I would first send you for the topology that interacts with this is Bjorner has a section called Topological Methods in a rather large two-volume series, which is nevertheless quite good, Handbook of Combinatorics. Okay? So, in particular, Bernd Sturmfels and Anders Bjorner have agreed to speak in the second week, and should Richard Stanley show up, he's in big trouble, but there's no sign that he's in the area yet. But what happens here is not only is this a route out for algebraic geometry to affect fields, but what's happening, any computational machinery lends more insight on the theory. So linear algebra and Gaussian elimination, we now know more about linear algebra because of Gaussian elimination. These interactions are kind of flowing back into algebra. In my opinion, there is original algebra in this book, there is original algebra in this book that is like the new shoots on the tree of what's happening to commutative algebra as a subject. And so if you want some inspiration for that, you look for new directions that people haven't considered yet out from this picture. I'm trying to give you a sense of where I think this is going. Okay, so let's go back to our example and try to introduce various characters that show up in this setting. Okay, so the first thing about our example is, no matter how you look at it, it's a very special example. First of all, it's a binomial ideal. Even computer scientists have considered binomial ideals. It's a word problem, a commutative word problem, where you say that this word is equivalent to this word, and this word is equivalent to this word, and then you ask questions like, can you prove the equivalence of two other words? That's just ideal membership in a binomial ideal. Some of the complexity results about how hard it is to do Grobner bases come from binomial ideals. So even though it might look like a special case, they can be as hard as anything we know. On the other hand, these aren't. This is actually an example of a toric ideal. And a toric ideal, there's various ways of characterizing it, but two monomials, I'm thinking of this specific ideal I, two monomials in F are equivalent mod I if, so the first characterization I want to give is they have the same degree with respect to two gratings on F. And I want to define the gratings as follows. I'm going to give the variables of F. Here is grating number one. Here is grating number two. And the first grating is 3, 2, 1, 0. The second grating is 0, 1, 2, 3. You recognize the columns of this matrix as just being the exponent vectors S cubed, S squared t, S t squared, t cubed. So in some sense, this is just a formalization of what we already knew, but it's another way of looking at it. So this thing induces an ideal. Just set any two terms equivalent to each other if they have the same grading in all senses that we're considering. And that defines an equivalence relation, which gives you the quotient S mod I. A second way of thinking about it is the different, so let me just write out the three examples. B squared minus AC, BC minus AD, and C squared minus BD. Let's just check. The degree of B squared is the same as the degree of AC is 4 comma 2. The degree here is 3 comma 3, and the degree here is 2 comma 4. And so the interesting fact now becomes that any equivalence induced by this grading is a consequence of these three equivalences. That's now what it means for these binomials to generate the binomial ideal. Okay, the second characterization, which also directly gets applied, is the difference of exponents belongs to the subgroup, which is often called a lattice, although be careful, various different things are called lattices in this area. Kernel of A, viewed as a subgroup of the full lattice Z to the 4. We have four variables, so we have four dimensions of Z to consider. Where A is just a further formalization of this table into a matrix, 3, 2, 1, 0, 0, 1, 2, 3. And, for example, we check B squared minus AC, the difference of the exponent vectors is minus 1, 2, minus 1, 0. BC minus AD, the difference is minus 1, 1, 1, minus 1. And C squared minus BD, the difference is 0, minus 1, 2, minus 1. And these all belong to the kernel of A. And this introduces a new point of view for how you can think of these special binomial ideals and slightly enlarges the class. You can take arbitrary subgroups of Zn and do the same thing. If the subgroup happens to be a kernel of a matrix, then it's what people call a toric ideal. More to say on that later. It might be of finite index in such a subgroup, in which case you would get an interesting ideal nevertheless. Okay. There's a third characterization, which is another important point of view when you're thinking about such ideals. When are two monomials equivalent mod I? They map to the same monomials in the subring. Now let's make a subring generated by those, we're just reusing the same terms over again, the S cubed, the S squared T. Form a subring, S squared cubed, S squared T, S T squared, T cubed, sitting inside S. So in other words, it's got one in it, it's got these four monomials in it, And you take any products you like and sums of those terms, and that's the risk. And this you can draw a nice picture of, because now we really are in two dimensions. So I'm going to lock it off like this so I can actually get the picture out. Here is one. In ST coordinates, it would be S cubed corresponds to A, but let's just call it A. The next one we can call B, the next one we call C, and the next one we call D. And these are the four sort of degree one stuff in the subring. Even though they are degree three as viewed in S, they're sort of the first layer in our subring. And then we have another row of monomials here, and then another row beyond that. So you can see what I mean by, if we look at the spot whose coordinates are 4, 2. So that takes us back to this original interpretation. Then we see that in this subring, there's actually two ways of computing this monomial, which correspond to the fact that two different, we have the map, which goes into here, whose kernel was our ideal I. That there are two ways of reaching this. We can reach this as B squared, but we can reach this as AC in the subring. Okay, so this subring is often referred to as a semigroup. And when you form a subring like this based on a semigroup, it's called a semigroup algebra. And people often think of the ordinary polynomial ring is just the first semigroup algebra. It's the one you get if your subgroup is just the natural numbers to the nth power. Okay. Yeah?
An older case where you're saying that K adjoining S cubed is simplified S, I think we've learned that S is being K adjoining A, B, C. Is that right?
Yeah. I gave you the wrong ring. Thank you. This sits inside the two-variable ring. Yes, very good. Don't you wish you'd said something sooner? Now that you know you're right. No. Yeah, okay, great. Okay, so now what can we do with all of this? So algebraic geometers, there's a question, or if somebody brings you something unidentified to a computer, what's the equivalent thing on a computer system that works in algebraic geometry to police running fingerprints to find out, you know, what you've got. The simplest question that one can ask is an algebraic geometer wants to know the following function. Now n is a degree because I'm using A, B, C, D. D isn't available to me as a degree. Forget that n used to be the number of variables somewhere. F of n is the function, which is the dimension of S mod I in degree n. So this is the homogeneous part of the quotient of degree n. So it's a finite dimensional vector space. It has some dimension. This function gives a series of dimensions as we vary n. And the reason an algebraic geometer wants to know this function is you tell them they're likely to tell you a lot about your curve. Later on, our principal emphasis will be a finer set of numbers that come from syzygies and related constructions in combinatorics, but they fit together to give this course description. So why an algebraic geometer wants to know is it tells a lot about the zero locus of I. In other words, what are all points in projective space where all the functions in I vanish? And the reason it tells a lot about is that similar loci have the same function f of n. So once you know the function f of n, you can just think of the simplest example that you can hold in your head that has the same function, and that gives you a clue to what your original algebraic variety looks like. And by the way, this is a polynomial in n for large n. It need not be a polynomial in small degrees, but it eventually settles down and gives you a polynomial everywhere. So rather than giving you the standard definition of some of the information, people tend to focus on the leading term of this. If you just be patient with me a moment, I will give you a nice description of all the terms of this polynomial. Okay, so it's a polynomial that all similar sets share, is what I'm saying here. But how do we compute? So in large part, what I'm going to tell you is many different perspectives for how someone might come up with the answer. What is that function? Okay, so the basic method of understanding it, and the one that was available in algebraic geometry without a computer, is syzygies. That's my plate in New York. My co-author on this program was very jealous when he saw this plate. What our program really does is compute syzygies. You know, sort of like most people have license plates telling you how they got rich. Well, this is telling you how we got poor. But, you know. But basically, if you want to look, if you look at the function, the basic function we're interested in, what does this function already look like for our polynomial ring in question in degree n? A basic counting argument will tell you that there is n plus 3, choose 3 monomials of degree n in the polynomial ring in 4 variables. So let's look at what this looks like, because we're going to need these numbers for a moment. You know, as n goes 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, this function grows 1, 4, 10, 20, 35. Okay? So there's a basic picture. If we want to understand, so this is S, we want to understand S mod I. That this is very schematic, but I hope that I'll try to explain it in a reasonable way. Think of the monomial 1 as sort of leading off that this is a picture of S. Okay? I mean, I'm drawing it like a cone, but really, S comes in layers. There's one dimension of constants, 4 dimensions of degree 1 variables, 10 dimensions of degree 2 forms, and we're trying to understand what some high degree slice of this looks like. We're trying to slice this in degree n. And we really want to understand the corresponding slice for the quotient. So we're getting way too many dimensions when we look at this picture. But we have an idea what dimensions we want to take out. Is a principal ideal looks just like the ring itself. It's just shifted up in degree. So somehow we want to carve back out all the stuff that's above one of our generators of our ring I. So let me draw gens of our ideal I. So we're going to draw, you know, dots for the generators of I. And, you know, a good first start would be to somehow subtract out dimensions corresponding to what each generator of I takes out of the picture. But if we try this, we're going to be off. So let's start this count, and this is one way of seeing from scratch what a syzygy really is. Okay? We're trying to predict what happens as these vector spaces fit together. And, you know, if you're asking yourself what's wrong with this picture, I mean, how does the theory of vector spaces go anyways? Whenever you want to do something like a counting argument for vector spaces, like how three of them intersect, you find a nice basis, and then you do your counting on that basis. And until you find a nice basis, it doesn't quite make sense. So in a way, what Grobner bases do is provide similar counting arguments in higher degrees. That our monomials are playing the role in allowing us to count things the way that bases were allowing us to count things in ordinary linear algebra. So I want to write the following chart. So first of all, gosh, I started it way over too far. So let's just go through those degrees, 1, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. And corresponding to the ring itself, I have the dimensions of the ring, 1, 4, 10, 20, 35. And this is overcounting the dimension sequence I want for S mod I. So I'm trying at the bottom of this table to end up with a description of the dimensions of S mod I. Okay, so I have the generator B squared minus AC, the generator BC minus AD, and the generator C squared minus BD. And I'm thinking of them as giving me sequences of numbers that grow, that it's a more precise version of what that vague sketch was trying to say, which is that we subtract out 1 in degree 2 for this generator, and it has four-dimensional space of multiples in the next step, which we subtract out, and we subtract out 10-dimensional space of degree 2 multiples of this expression in the degree 4, and so forth. And we do this 3 times. And if you were to add this up, you would get the wrong answer. However, acidity tells you how you got the wrong answer. The reason you got the wrong answer is it's a linear algebra version of inclusion-exclusion counting. Is you were trying to throw out things you didn't want, but you threw out some things too much. But only in the linear algebra sense can we say what we threw out too much. There's actually, in higher degrees, linear dependencies between these multiples. So in fact, we get the form d times, we can write the expression 0 equals d times b squared minus ac minus c times bc minus ad plus b times c squared minus bd. We think of this as being a collision in degree 3. The fact that when you expand this out, there are 6 terms, but they occur in pairs with opposite signs and cancel out the 0, is telling you how those cones sort of cross each other in that schematic picture up there. Okay? So we've basically, for this dependency, we've thrown out a dimension twice in degree 3, so we should add it back in. And it grows just like the original function, 1, 4. And there's a similar form that has C's instead of, just shift the variables down by 1. You can check that this form here also is a syzygy. And so when we add back in 1, 4, it turns out that if we were working with a bigger problem, we'd now have to worry, first of all, just as these were the only generators we needed to consider, any other relation could be inferred from these. So they together covered everything we need to throw out. Similarly, inside a module of all possible vectors D, C, B, these two basic syzygies generate all possibilities for the syzygies among the generators. But in general, we might have syzygies among the syzygies and so forth. And David Hilbert proved about 100 years ago that if you keep going, this process eventually stops. Here, it stops for us now. So since it stopped for us now, we can add this up. We have 1, 4, 7, 10, 13. Is that right? All right, okay. So this is the function that an algebraic geometer wanted to see. Now, why did an algebraic geometer want to see this function? You might see something in a book about, well, the leading coefficient, if you normalize it by some factorial, is blah, 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 planes and medians. The way that you want to think about this is you want to write down the functions of spaces you do understand. So, for example, P0 is just a point. It corresponds to the ring in one variable. And the ring in one variable has a function f of n equals n plus 0 choose 0, which just happens to be 1. Okay? The projective line, which is just a line, corresponds to the ring in two variables, and the function you get for it is n plus 1 choose 1, which just reduces to n plus 1. And similarly, if you keep going for all higher ones, P2 has 3 variables, which gives us n plus 2 choose 2. And it turns out that the polynomial that you get here is f of n equals 3n plus 1. It happens to be a polynomial right from the get-go. Like I said, this is a very special example. Often it takes a while to settle down. Just like often, you need to consider second syzygies. I mean, a lot of things are simple about this example. But what's the easiest way of understanding this polynomial? You can rewrite it as a combination of these basis polynomials. And if you do so, then you recognize this polynomial as somehow indicating a combination of different projective spaces. And so this is 3 times this minus 2 times this. So we can write it as 3p1 minus 2p0. So if we can somehow draw the configuration of 3 projective lines meeting in 2 points, we now have an object which is very similar to the original object we asked the computer to recognize for us. What do 3 lines meeting in 2 points look like? Well, here's a picture of 3 lines meeting in 2 points. So now you can answer questions about the original curve. Like, if you were to pass a general plane through the original curve, how many points would it hit? Well, you look at this configuration. You pass a general plane through this configuration, and it hits each line once. We get 3. So we infer that for the original curve, that we would have gotten 3 points if we ran. I mean, this is one of many ways in which similar sets share the same Hilbert polynomial. Okay, so it's this function that we're interested in. For today's example, I want to show you some interactions between fields that come up with that function. Question? Oh, it was just the board squeaking at me. Okay, so how can we make the same count combinatorially? Okay, there are a number of different ways of answering this question. Okay, now one is we really did this the hard way. By far the easiest way of seeing this function is just to notice that K of A, B, C, D modulo our ideal, which is the ring we're trying to understand, is isomorphic to the subring K of S cubed, S squared T, S T squared, T cubed sitting inside K of S comma T. So we go over to this picture, and we know what the dimension of the quotient is supposed to be. We're supposed to get 1 basis vector in degree 1, these 4 basis vectors in degree 4. These 7 monomials in the subring correspond to the 7 dimensions of the quotient. These 10 correspond to the 10 dimensions in the quotient. We just count. We get f of n is equal to 3n plus 1. And, you know, we're just worrying about syzygies among binomials. And what were we thinking? Okay? This is something which is studied in other fields. This is called the Ehrhart polynomial. The context in which it shows up is more generally, it counts lattice points in polyhedral cones. You somehow think of the first quadrant in this plane as being a polyhedral cone, except that instead of having all the lattice points in the plane, we just have every third row of lattice points. And, you know, so people under different languages study this exact same function. And you can see they have a much easier time seeing what it is than we do in this example. Okay? So that's one comment, is we did this the hard way. Okay? On the other hand, what's the by-the-book algorithmic way to do this? Maybe we'll learn more. Like I said, there's a finer set of numbers lurking behind these coarse numbers, which really tell us a lot about the curve. Well, the motivation for why, for example, my computer program with Mike Stillman was called Macaulay is there's a theorem well covered in Cox, Little, and O'Shea due to Macaulay that the dimension of S mod I in degree n is equal to the dimension of F mod n of I in dimension, in degree n. That basically the Grobner basis relates to a basis for this space in the degree. You take a multiple of a Grobner basis vector element with the lead term giving you each monomial in the ideal, and that gives you a basis for the ideal, and the lead terms give a basis for this ideal. So there are as many basis vectors as there are lead terms of basis vectors. This is the essence of the proof. I'm not going into this proof, but this is something in the books. So what this tells us, and what the computer always does, because the computer doesn't know if there's some special case like this, is we switch to the study of the monomial ideal in of I. And as I said earlier, we're already in combinatorics when we do that. So now f of n, we can give a completely combinatorial description of what the function we're interested in is the number of monomials in S of degree n, not a multiple of b squared, bc, or c squared. So in a way, you're going to realize that the whole idea of a syzygy was just a linear algebra version of inclusion-exclusion counting. But like I said, all linear algebra dimension counts are easiest when you reduce to bases and just count. And that's what the Grobner basis has done for us, is that the monomials play the role of what basis elements played before. Now we have monomials everywhere, we just count. We have to make sure we count how many monomials are outside the ideal, and that gives us our answer. Okay. So, I'll leave this up for comparison, because the board I'm about to create will be very similar, but at the same time, somewhat different. The most straightforward way of doing this count, and the one probably that most of you have seen, is do you think of the set, you have our initial ideal, n of I is b squared, bc, c squared. Let's name the generators 1, 2, and 3. I want to do a count very much like above. Only want to think about it slightly differently, which is the empty set corresponds to none of the generators. And really what I want to know, I want to know everything outside the generators of the ideal. So I'm going to write down the same series of dimensions, 1, 4, 10, 20, 35, corresponding to the empty set. And now I've counted all monomials. But I only wanted to count monomials that weren't multiples of these monomials. So now, inclusion-exclusion would say that I now subtract for the sets 1, 2, and 3, corresponding to multiples of b squared, multiples of bc, and multiples of c squared. So far, the picture looks just like it did before. But now I have to, now that I can more clearly in a combinatorial way see the overlaps. There is a point at which 1 and 2 overlap. So I have to count back in anything which is a multiple of both the first and the second generator. Now how do you tell if something is both a multiple of b squared and bc? It's a multiple of their least common multiple, b squared c. And let me just finish off this chart. I have 1 comma 3 and 2 comma 3 corresponding to, now this is b squared c squared and this is bc squared. And the only thing wrong if I keep going this far is that if something was a multiple of everything, I would have added it in, thrown it out 3 times, added it back in 3 times, still in. I don't want it in, so I got to subtract it out. So what is the common multiple of all 3 factors? It's b squared, c squared. So I do 1, 4, 1, 1, 4, and a minus 1. Notice I started up, I choked up another degree here for this. So inclusion-exclusion it's not very efficient, but it considered all the cases. And the difference between the first calculation we made and this calculation is these two terms which canceled out on us. Okay? So the combinatorists have thought about counting problems a long time. So there's a combinatorial structure which combinatorists like to use, which gives us a much sharper way of thinking about such counts. Okay? And to define that, I want to introduce another one of the actors in this series of ideas. What is a partially ordered set known as a poset? It's simply a set where sometimes we have an order relation. That's what it means it's partially ordered. And this order relation obeys the usual rules. Okay? And in terms of partially ordered sets, combinatorists have a sharper theory of counting things. So for us, what partially ordered set is at the heart of what we're trying to do here? Well, we're interested in the relationships between the different least common multiples of monomials generating our ideal. So we have a picture. The empty set corresponds to 1. So I want to take LCM poset, where less than or equal to corresponds to divisibility. Okay? So strict so another way of saying that is less than corresponds to strict divisibility. So I get 1, b squared, bc, and c squared. And then above this, I have b squared c and bc squared. And finally, above this, I have b squared c squared. And I'm drawing a picture, which is the usual picture combinatorists draw to draw a partially ordered set, is there's a path going up from an element to another element when the elements are comparable. Are comparable. So 1 strictly divides b squared c. So we can find a path going up from 1 through bc, which it also divides, to b squared c. But say b squared and bc squared can't be compared. So there's no rising path that goes from b squared to bc squared. You could put arrows on this if it would help, but people don't because they simply say all the edges go up, and then they don't need to put arrows, just to save a little bit of clutter. Okay? So these were all the different terms we actually considered in this inclusion-exclusion count. And it turns out that if we want to consider the role that these terms actually played, this term got used twice with opposite signs. So it's as if it got used with a coefficient of 0. If we understand the roles each of these terms played, it's only the order structure on the lattice, on the poset here, that matters. So I draw a picture of the same partially ordered set, but I'm leaving off which monomial was which. And I've forgotten what the degrees are because I haven't labeled my points. But this describes a partially ordered set. From this picture, somebody can see that the set consists of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 elements. They can tell when one element is less than another element. That's all there is to say about a partially ordered set. And the numbers we were interested in, we used this plus 1 in our count. We used these points minus 1 in our count. We used this plus 1 in our count, this plus 1 in our count. And we use this 0 in our count. Okay, so now I'm going to show you something of a miracle. There really isn't time today to really show you why this holds, but we're going to it's representative of relationships which we're going to be looking at. Is that actually a partially ordered set is the essence of topology. I mean, not perhaps the topology that working algebraic topologists do, but there's a lot of easy topology which turns out to be incredibly useful in algebra if you can see how to get it in. And there's a relationship, whenever you have order relationships, such as divisibility, there's a way of thinking of those order relationships as topology. So I want to define a topological space for you. I'm going to define a topological space. Its name in the literature is the order complex of the open interval x comma y for x less than y in a poset. Okay? And I'm just going to very informally define the space because we haven't even really said what a superficial complex is, and not everyone necessarily knows. Always include the empty set. It turns out being very important to keep track of the empty set in algebra. It isn't always thought of in topology because you can't see it. Now, include a point z whenever you have the relationship z fits in between x and y in the poset. Okay? And similarly, include a line segment wz whenever you can squeeze w less than z inside the interval in the poset. And by the same token, you put in a triangle whenever you have a triple of elements which are strictly comparable but squeezed inside the interval in the poset. And glue them all together. In other words, just fit them together in whatever, you know, in the natural way where, you know, a line segment gets glued to its two points. A triangle gets glued to the line segments, which form the sides of the triangle, and so forth. Okay, so let's apply this construction for various intervals starting from the bottom in this picture. Okay, so I'm going to do from 1 to b squared, and that's a tight interval. I mean, it's b squared covers 1 in the language of posets. There's no element strictly between b1 and b squared. So none of this stuff happens. All we do is include the empty set. That happens to be the case for the interval to bc and the interval to c squared. In all three cases, we just get the empty set. On the other hand, the other topological spaces are a little more interesting. If we look at the topological space constructed by going from 1 to b squared c, well, the list looks like the empty set b squared and bc, because both b squared and bc fit are squeezed in ascending relationships between 1 and b squared c. Okay, so if you think of this as a space inside this box, and we draw the space, it's a space that consists of two points, and those two points can be labeled b squared and bc. Now similarly, if I do the same construction for 1 and bc squared, I won't do the intermediate drawing, but I again get a space consisting of two points, only now the two points are bc and c squared. And then the really interesting interval, since what's most perplexing about this simple example is why did we get a 0 for the top coefficient in our counting arguments? Is if we do the interval from 1 to b squared c squared, exercise following this definition, you get the points b squared c, bc, bc squared, and c squared. Those are the points you get. Notice that all five of those elements are elements that can be found on paths going up from 1 to b squared c. But we also have some line segments, because we can do a chain b squared to b squared c. So we glue in a line segment here. And there's a chain from bc to b squared c. So we glue in a line segment here, and so forth. Okay. So now, the reduced Euler characteristic It's the ordinary electric characteristics with a twiddle on top. That twiddle is a warning to topologists to be careful because we're doing this right. If we start with the empty set, and you count minus one for the empty set, you count plus one for each point, you count minus one for each one face or line segment, again plus one for each triangle or two simplex, and you add this up. If you're familiar with homology, this has an interpretation in terms of homology groups, and the finer structure we're interested in, that's like the individual syzygies, shows up again in this picture. The finer structure would not be this Euler characteristic, but the specific dimensions of the specific homology computations for these spaces. But if we go around and look at this, we get an Euler characteristic here of minus one, which is exactly the opposite we get an Euler characteristic here of plus one and an Euler characteristic here of plus one. And the nice thing with the reduced Euler characteristic is that it's zero on trivial spaces. It doesn't mean that the space is trivial if the Euler characteristic is zero. It's a very crude diagnostic. But in particular, spaces which can be collapsed to a point only have an Euler characteristic of zero because they share that property with the point, that the empty set cancels out the point. Okay? And now if you look back at our picture, I mean, minus one, minus one, minus one, plus one, plus one, zero, we've recovered the original, we recovered the counting coefficients that we were interested in understanding. Okay, so this may seem, for someone coming from algebra, this may seem, if you haven't seen this before, this might seem the most mysterious of the things I've been talking about. But in fact, it's very natural because a, let me start on the other board. Because a standard example of a partially ordered set comes from topology. And once I show you this relationship, I think you'll recognize what's going on in that construction. Okay? So the relationship is this, is start with a topological space. You don't need to know what these words mean if you don't already, but it's going to happen to be a cell complex, which is the square. Okay? So I'm going to take an ordinary square, and I'm going to decompose the square into its constituent pieces. So I'm going to think of the square as being its four corners, its four sides, and its inside. Okay? And then let me give these constituent pieces names, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I. And now I can form a partially ordered set from this cell complex by simply, recording a less than whenever one of these cells lies in the boundary of the other cell. Like, you know, A is on one end of E, so A is less than E. E is on one side of I, so E is less than I. And I get a poset which looks like this, A, B, C, D. And then above here, I'm going to put E, which has both A and B less than it, F, which has both B and C less than it, G, which has both C and D less than it, H, which has D and A less than it, and then I has, it covers the four edges, and then by longer paths is greater than BD. And then I'm going to cap this off. I'm going to put something like the empty set at the bottom. I'm going to put a unique minimum element to this poset. And for overkill, I'm just going to put a unique maximum element on this poset also. And this is the poset I want to show you as a final example. Okay? Because for this example, I can just mimic the construction that I can mimic the construction that we went through to recover the counting coefficients when we were looking at the Hilbert function, is the name of this function we've been studying all morning. And if I mimic it here, what is the space which is the topological space built from the interval, which is the whole thing, from the entire bottom to the entire top? I will draw it for you. I leave it as an exercise that you check that this drawing is correct. What are the points? Well, I'm going to have 9 points, as I can see. So I'm going to lay the 9 points out like this. Okay, I'm going to call them A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I. Okay, and now I'm going to draw edges between the points whenever there's an order relationship. So E covers A and B, F covers B and C, G covers C and D, H covers A and D, I covers E, F, G, and H. But this definition also allows for gaps. I mean, that there's a line segment between B and I, for example, because B is less than I, and they both squeeze inside that interval between 0 and 1. So when I finish it off, I draw in a segment like this, 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 and this. And then I've got some triangles now. There's enough room in here to squeeze in 3 things in a row. So for example, going up the left edge, AEI gives me a triangle. It's this triangle here. And if I consider all the different paths, like AHI is another triangle, that there's a one-to-one correspondence between those rising paths there, and it happens that we fill in all the triangles in this picture. Okay? So we get a space homeomorphic to the original space, giving us the face poset. This, I mean, one simple name of this poset we're considering was the face poset. In fact, if you've studied any topology, you'll recognize this construction. When you take a triangulation or a cell complex and you chop it up finer by sticking in a new point in the middle of every cell and then cutting it everywhere you can, it's called the barycentric subdivision. Okay, so this is the barycentric subdivision of the original square we started with. So the essence of the combinatorial view for this kind of topology, and again, I said Bjorner's section in the Handbook of Combinatorics is a great place to start. You get a topological space from any poset. It didn't have to come from a topological space in the first place. I mean, each time you take a barycentric, like, you could now take the poset of this and take its order complex, what would you get? Well, you get the barycentric subdivision of this picture. So each time you run a lap where you start with the face poset, take the barycentric, take the order complex of it to get a barycentric subdivision, you get something chopped up finer. But this is saying that any poset is just one step away from joining this family of examples. You take the order complex the first time, you're in a triangulated space. You take its face poset and take the order complex again, you're in a more finely triangulated space. But this allows us to think of any order relationship as topology. See, that doesn't look like there's a lot of topology in algebra, but there's a lot of order relationships in algebra. And so a lot of what one does is, you know, one recognizes homology groups of topological spaces as being equivalent to these various numbers that in algebra that come up when you're counting syzygies. There are duality theorems in topology. The Alexander duality telling you how something inside a sphere relates to its complement. That also, starts cropping up all over the place once you recognize topology lurking within the algebra. So part of what we'll be showing you is in that direction. This ties in well with, for example, hyperplane arrangements and linear space arrangements, which is another area with lots of applications, you know, representation theory and so forth, but where these ideas come together. So Soren will start, like I said, he'll be less of a survey and more of a technical lecture in the afternoon. I could take questions. The other thing is somebody stayed up all night changing the entire computer system. And when I was in high school and he wanted the afternoon off, we would get everybody to check their watches, okay? And they'd go in and everybody would flush at exactly the same second. It would break the pipes and they'd have to send us all home, right? Okay, so what you could do is you could go up in 10 minutes and everybody checked their email at exactly the same time. And this will be a test of the new computer system that they put in. And the guy will get to go home once he realizes it works okay. Okay. So, in any case, any questions? Good. Well, that's not good, actually. It's terrible. You'll get more used to the idea that we're like six of us talking in an office. I'll take better questions later. But, hammer us with questions outside. And have great pizza, and I'll see you in the afternoon. Thanks.